What I'm talking about tonight is one of the very important aspects of biblical interpretation, and that has to do with the historical context of the Bible. And it's so important that we, when we read the Bible, that we read it in context. Context is king when it comes to biblical interpretation. And there's more than one context. And there's our personal context, you know, what we bring to the text. There's the literary context, where the text is. And Dr. Johns talked about that, I believe, last time. And the historical context, and something that we really need to pay attention to and often don't. But so tonight, we'll just move on to our first slide here, which is the two contexts. One is the literary context, and the literary context studies the written text. The historical context studies the people and culture receiving the text. So the literary context is concerned about the text, as a piece of writing, as a sample of language, and all of that. So with literary context, you don't really have to pay that much attention to the author. But with the historical context, we're trying to get at the author's intention. We believe that the meaning of the text comes from the author. It doesn't come from the reader. We don't make anything we want out of the text. We try to find out what the author was trying to say when they wrote the text. And historical context is a way of trying to sort of get at the mind of the author to gain the perspective of the original writer and the readers. So we can, okay, I think I, there we go. What is the goal? The goal is authorial intent. Well, what is that? How'd that get there? I don't know. To discover the author's intended meaning and to get to the mind of the author. In order to do that, we have to understand something about him, the world he lived in, the situation that existed when the text was written, and so forth. So this is what we do. When we interpret our Constitution, if you're a sort of a strict constructionist like I am, then you believe that if you want to understand the Constitution, then you have to understand it in terms of what the framers intended when they wrote it. And in order to get at the intention of the framers, you might have to read other things that they wrote, like the Federalist Papers or some of the letters and other things that people who were involved in this process. You might have to know some of the history of what led to the Constitutional Convention, what motivated them to have it, what motivated them to add the Bill of Rights and other things of that nature. And then you get at the meaning. The Constitution isn't something that you can make say what you want to say. At least you shouldn't, but people do. So in order to reach the goal, in order to get at the author's intention, we have to gain the perspective of the author and his readers. And so I use a textbook at Evangel called Grasping God's Word. I don't, some of you may be familiar with it. And it has a process that is called the interpretive journey. And the interpretive journey starts with grasping the text in their town. In other words, trying to gain the perspective of the original writers. And then there's a river between us and the world of the text. That's called the river of differences in the text. Some places that river is wide, hard to get over. Some places it's narrow, it's easier to get over. But there still is differences between our world and their world. And if we want to gain their perspective, we have to kind of get across that river. And then, of course, we want to, once we have gained their perspective, we want to find out the principles that are in the text, and then we want to recast the message in terms that are meaningful and relevant to our world so that we can live it and apply it to our lives. So we have to make that journey. We can't interpret the text. We can't go straight from text to application. We have to go text, interpretation, application. If you go straight from text to application, then the possibility is that you apply it wrong. And you apply it in a way that was not intended by the biblical writer. Okay? Three steps. One is, I already mentioned that, visit the world of the text. Another is, discover the occasion of writing, the circumstances that brought the text into being. And the third is to investigate the biblical actors. Who are the people involved? What role do they play in this text? What does the text say about them? What concerns do they have? And things of that nature. So let's look at step one. Visit the world of the text. If we want to understand the text, then we have to deal with history. I don't know if everybody's a history lover. I love history. Anybody else love history out there? But it's a historical document. God gave us a document that was written in a particular time, in a particular place in history. And we have to understand its historical situatedness so that before we can understand what it meant to them. And we can't understand what it means to us until we understand what it meant to them. So, one thing we need to do is become familiar with the sweep of biblical history. I mean, we need to have a general grasp of the progress of biblical history, the main events and the sequence of those events, from the creation of the world to the cross and beyond, right? And once we have that, we can situate our text in that historical process, and that will help us to understand it. So, here's a brief outline of biblical history. It starts with the primeval history. That's Genesis 1 to 11, creation, the fall, flood, Tower of Babel. Then the patriarchal history, that's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Genesis 12 to 50. Then we have the Exodus and conquest, the period of the judges, the united monarchy, the divided monarchy in 931 BC. The kingdom of Israel was split in two, a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And from that point on, it was on two tracks. And then in around 722, that came to an end when the Assyrians destroyed Samaria and carried off a large bit of the population into exile. In 586 BC, the kingdom of Judah came to an end when the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, carried the people off into exile. The Babylonian exile, beginning of the end, was when Cyrus conquered Babylon in 538 BC. And that began a period of Persian rule, but the Jews began to go back to Palestine. And then the Old Testament period really kind of comes to an end with the writing of the last books of the Old Testament, like 1st and 2nd Chronicles around 400 BC. And then the end of Persian rule begins. Persian rule comes to an end in 331 BC with Alexander the Great and his conquest of Persia. And then we have Greek rule for a period of time. And then the Greek rule comes to an end in 160 BC with the Maccabean Revolt. And there's a period of independence for people of Israel. Then in about 163 BC, the Roman general Pompey comes to Jerusalem and brings Palestine under Roman control. From that point forward, they're under Roman rule. Then, of course, the birth of Christ between 6 and 4 BC, the death of Christ around 30 AD. And then we have, of course, the period of after the resurrection, the period of the apostolic mission, and then the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, which was a major sort of milestone. It marked really the end of the cooperation of the church and the synagogue. The church and the synagogue were on dual tracks after that. And then the destruction of Jerusalem in 135 BC after the revolt of Simon Bar Kokhba. And that brought the state of Israel to an end. So this is kind of a touch on the highlights of biblical history. Really, it helps to understand the text if we can locate the text in this historical process and see how it fits into the redemptive historical work of God and what it how it contributes to that process. The next thing we need to know something about, of course, is geography. Anybody good at geography? You know north from east and west and south and all that kind of stuff? Hopefully we'll get an A-plus in geography. Know something about the world of the Bible, right? We need to know something about the environment in which the biblical events took place. This is a map of the Old Testament world. You can see the major regions of the Old Testament world. Egypt, of course, Canaan, which we call the Syro-Palestinian region. We've got Arabia there. We have Persia, Elam, and Media over here in the Zagros Mountains. And then, of course, Mesopotamia is a very important region with Babylon and the Assyrian Empire in the north. There's Assyria there. And then, of course, Asia Minor, otherwise known as Anatolia or Turkey today. And you'll notice as you look at the biblical world of the Old Testament that it looks eastward. It looks to the east. Now, I'm sure that the people of the biblical world were aware of the Mediterranean world, the Greeks and other people in North Africa and places like that. But these regions were really on the extreme edge of their horizon. They really did not know much about the world beyond that. And so, unfortunately, the people in the Old Testament did not know there was an America. They didn't know America existed. They didn't know China existed. They knew a very limited area of the globe, and they all kind of looked to the east. And then, of course, we go to the New Testament world, and once we get into the New Testament world, we see that it really is coextensive with the Roman Empire. Now, I'm sure that the apostles and early Christians, they did evangelize Egypt, and they did evangelize to the east here. But the New Testament is primarily concerned with the movement of the church to the west. And the book of Acts begins in Jerusalem and ends where? Well, it ends in Rome. So it's moving west. And we see the Apostle Paul kind of in the vanguard of that movement, taking the gospel first to Asia Minor and then to Macedonia and Greece. And then later on, he visited Rome, and he had intentions to go to Spain. And so we see that the world of the New Testament looks more west, and we see a much greater influence of Western cultures like Greece and Rome on the world of the apostles and of Jesus. This is a map of the Holy Land. It's a kind of a basic map that shows the four longitudinal regions of the Holy Land. And you can see here, of course, the Mediterranean Sea to the west. You can see the coastal plain here, the central highlands. Right there, it's broken up by the Jezreel Valley. And then, of course, the Jordan Rift that runs down all the way to the Red Sea, and then, of course, we have the Transjordan Plateau. And as you look at the land of Israel, it's really oriented to the east. If you go to the east here, you'll find Arabia, right? This is desert over here. And so it's really important, I think, to know the geography of the biblical world so that you can know what people are talking about when they mention things and how those things are important and significant for people's lives. For instance, in the Old Testament, the east wind is always a bad thing. Anytime the east wind is blowing, bad things happen. It dries up your crops. If you're a farmer and you're looking for rain and the east wind starts blowing, forget about it. You're not going to get any rain. And so you see here's a quote from Isaiah 27:8, measure by measure, by exile, you contended with them. He removed them with his fierce breath in the day of the east wind. So that reference to the east wind, that's the wind that comes in off the desert. Now, if the wind's coming from the west, it's coming in off the sea. And so you're likely to get rain. That's a good thing. So it's just to know about the world of the text, the geography, and these different features can open up to you the significance of different allusions to geographical realities and things of that nature. Also, another thing we want to know about the biblical world, we want to know about agriculture. What did people grow? How did they live? How did they subsist? What was their lives like? And these folks in the biblical world, they ate primarily olives. Olives were an important crop. People in biblical times did not eat a lot of meat. Most of their diet was made up of bread and other things of that nature. So olive oil was very important. You need a source of fat in your diet, and olive oil provided that source of fat for them. Also grapes in the form of course, fruit, and also raisins, and also wine was an important commodity in those days. Figs, wheat, and barley, these are not the only products that they grew. These are not the only crops that they had, but they're the main staple items that were grown and consumed by the people in Israel. Of course, livestock would include sheep and goats, oxen, donkeys, and things like that. The Israelites were not big fans of horses. Horses were associated mainly with Egypt. As a matter of fact, God told them not to multiply horses, and they didn't generally fight their battles with chariots. Most of the Israelite battles were fought on foot, and so horses were not a big part of what they did. Donkeys were the common sort of pack animal. When Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were traveling around as nomads, of course, camels were important to them, but once they were settled in the land, camels are more associated with Arabs and Bedouins and people of that nature. Culture. Let's talk a little bit about biblical culture. Culture is important. Culture is a whole constellation of things that people make up the world that people live in. And it has to do with language. Language is an important aspect of culture. Hebrew was the spoken language. It's a Semitic language. It's part of a family of languages known as Northwest Semitic languages. And, of course, rituals, customs, relationships, practices, behaviors, values, ways of interacting with people, those are all cultural factors that people deal with and that make up their daily life. I think in order to understand the biblical text and the biblical world, we might need to know something about their cultural practices, their customs, their family arrangements, and their social arrangements and things of that nature. So, the biblical social world. Let's talk a little bit about what it was like to live in Israelite society. When we talk about the social world of the Bible, we're talking about a patriarchal society. Patriarchy means the rule of fathers. And in Israelite society, generally, males were in charge. So in the family, the father was the person who was in authority. The main kinship group was called the Beit Av, or the father's house. And the father's house included the mother and father, all right, their unmarried daughters, their sons, and their wives. Because when women got married in biblical times, they moved in with their in-laws. That's what they did. It's patrilocal. You move in with your husband's parents. And once you get there, you're not going to have your own sort of house by yourself. You're going to be under the tutelage of your mother-in-law. And so you have the mother, the father, unmarried daughters, the sons and their wives and their children in this Beit Av. So if you're living in the family is not the nuclear family like we're used to it, mother, father, sister, brother, us four and no more. It's an extended family. So you're growing up with your first cousins. And so some sociologists have suggested that in one of these kinship groups, this father's house, you could have as many as 30 people that were part of that group. And so it's always extended family. And patrilineal, that means that your genealogy is traced through your male ancestors. It's also a stratified society. In America, we're used to the idea that we're all created equal and nobody's above anybody else, and we're kind of used to an egalitarian society. But in biblical society, people had there was a social order and social rank that was very closely adhered to. The vast majority of people in the biblical world were at the bottom. Throughout most of history, the vast majority of people have been poor. Only a very few people have been well off. Most people lived barely hand to mouth. And the situation that we have enjoyed in America and in the West for the past 100 years is really kind of an anomaly in human history. So it's hard for us sometimes to understand just how that was. But people knew their rank, they knew where they belonged, and they stayed in their place, if you will. That's something that kind of rankles us as American because we don't like to think about social rank. But that was something that they lived with every day, and that was part of their world. It was an oral society, meaning that the vast majority of people were illiterate. And I think Dr. Johns made this point the other day. We're used to high rates of literacy. We have public education. We learn to read when we're 5 or 6 years old, and virtually everybody reads. But in biblical times, only a very few people were literate. And so most of the stories and traditions and teachings that were given in oral form. And so that doesn't mean there wasn't writing. We have evidence of writing in the biblical world going back for a long, long ways. It just means that most of the people couldn't do it and didn't have the training necessary to do it. Also, in the biblical world, people did not view themselves as individuals. Once again, this is something that we don't understand in the West because we're used to thinking of ourselves as individuals. You know, as Rush Limbaugh says, that rugged individualism, right? We want to be the master of our own destiny. We want to make our own decisions. We don't want to live by other people's rules and things like that. The people in the biblical world would not have understood that at all. In the biblical world, your identity is determined by the group that you belong to, primarily your family, then your clan, and your tribe, and then perhaps your nation. And so this dyadic personality means that your sense of self-worth, the dyadic means a kind of has two parts, right? You're an individual, but you're also part of a group. Your sense of self-worth, your sense of meaning and purpose came from the group. So you cared very much what people thought about you. Your reputation, your honor rating, and we'll talk a little here about honor ratings here in just a second, was very important to you. And to be shamed before your group was a very serious thing for people in these cultures. And so it was very important to them to have the approval of that group. The honor and shame culture. The culture of the Mediterranean world, both under the Old Testament and the New Testament, was an honor and shame culture. In other words, you were once again concerned about your public reputation, about people's opinions of you and things like that. People in the biblical world did not say, "I don't care what you think." They cared very much what you think. And oftentimes, you were born, let me just say this, there's two kinds of honor. You are born. There's the honor that you're born with, that's inherited honor, that's the honor that comes from your family. So if you belong to a good family, a respectable family, and you go into town, and somebody says, well, that's so-and-so's son. He comes from a good family. People treat you better because they respect your family. Then there's the acquired honor. That's the honor that you get by virtue of your own achievements. And so everybody wants to maintain their family's honor. They don't want to bring shame on their family. And they want to gain honor for themselves. Now, honor is a limited commodity. So that means that if somebody gets honor, somebody else loses it. So oftentimes, this is called an agonistic culture, which means it's a competitive culture, primarily males competing for honor in the public square. So what there's a very common aspect of this agonistic culture is what's called the honor challenge. So somebody makes a claim to honor, you know, I am a prophet. That's a claim to honor. I speak for God. And then somebody else comes up and challenges them. You remember the story of Jeremiah and Hananiah? Jeremiah is wearing this yoke, prophesying. With this yoke, God is going to carry off these nations into Babylon. And then Hananiah, the prophet, came up to Jeremiah, and he takes the yoke off of him, and he breaks it. Thus says the Lord, I have broken the yoke of the Babylonians. Then Jeremiah's like, whoa, what? What did you just do? And so what you have there is an honor challenge. You have one prophet challenging another in front of other people. It's always done in front of an audience, and there is always a verdict as to who won. And so the person that wins the honor challenge, his honor rating goes up. The person that loses the honor challenge, his honor rating goes down. We see this in the Gospels. When the Pharisees come and ask Jesus questions in front of people, they're not just wanting to debate. They're wanting to shame him. You see, he has made a claim to honor. I'm a teacher sent from God. And so they come up with these very clever questions to trap him. Only Jesus wins every time, right? They always go away with their tail between their legs. Jesus wins these honor challenges, and his honor rating goes up. The people are amazed. Their honor rating goes down. That's why they hated him. And so this honor and shame thing, this is America, the West. We used to have more of the honor culture in our culture. That's kind of gone away now. About the place where you have the honor culture the most in our current day is in the military. But outside of that, we don't do that. But you know, there was a time when if you insulted somebody, you might have to go out back and step off 10 paces and turn around and take a shot at him. Let him take a shot at you. That's, you know, a duel or something of that nature. And even today in the Middle East, that honor culture is still very much in place. And I think sometimes in our interactions with the people in the Middle East, we fail to take that into account, what motivates people to do what they're doing. Another aspect of this is, of course, patronage. There's lots of poor people, and in biblical times, there was no bank that you could go to for a loan. If you wanted to go to college, the government was not going to help you. So if you needed help, who did you go to? You went to a rich person. Maybe you had a rich uncle, or maybe there's a rich guy in town, and you go to him and you ask him to help you. And you're okay. I don't know if you remember the movie The Godfather, right on the day of his daughter's wedding. People are coming around asking him favors. And what's going on there? They need favors. He's in a position to grant them, but if he gives you a favor, you incur obligation, right? So we call patron-client relationship. The patron is a person who gains honor from having clients, people that are beholden to him. Oftentimes these patrons, they're wealthy people, and they want clients that are important and impressive. So they like to support playwrights and philosophers and people like that. They like to have these guys in their stable of clients, so that increases their honor rating. That's part of the reason why Paul, when he went to Corinth, he did the tent-making thing. He did not take money from them. He told them, I robbed others, taking wages of them to do you service. Why did he do that? Because he knew the Corinthians, and he knew that if he took money from them, they would think they had a patron-client relationship with him, and he did not want to get into that situation. And so he avoided it. So patronage and client relationship, you help somebody out, and then that incurs obligation. Now, sometimes, if you want to be a patron, if you're a wealthy person and you have somebody you want to support and they refuse patronage, then that incurs enmity, okay? So Paul may have made some people mad by refusing their patronage at Corinth. In the New Testament world, we basically have the Roman world. The Roman world is basically a Roman veneer of Roman organization, Roman rule, over an underlying substratum of Greek culture. The Romans basically took over the culture of the Greeks. And the main language, the lingua franca, during the Hellenistic period, the Roman period, was Greek. That's why the letters and the writings of the New Testament are all written in Greek, even though it was a period of Roman rule. So those are some aspects of the biblical social world, things like that, that we need to kind of get a grasp on if we want to understand what people are doing and why they are doing it. Religion is important as well. Israel, Judaism, and early Christianity existed in a polytheistic environment. They were surrounded by polytheists, people that believed that there were lots of gods. They personified the forces of nature and worshiped them, and Israel had to cope with that. Also, many points of contact with other cultures and their religious practices. When you look at the Bible, you see that the Israelites had prophets. The Canaanites had prophets. Remember the prophets of Baal? The Israelites offered sacrifice. Their neighbors offered sacrifice. The Israelites had a wisdom tradition. Their neighbors had a wisdom tradition. The Egyptians had a very robust wisdom tradition. There's also wisdom literature from Mesopotamia, from Babylon and Assyria, and Canaanite wisdom literature. So there's lots of points of contact. Israel did not exist in a vacuum. Israel was not sealed off from its neighbors, but it was part of a larger Near Eastern culture, a lot of whose practices and assumptions they shared. So if we study ancient Near Eastern culture, we can learn something about the culture of the people in the Bible. Ancient Israelite religion, is not simply equivalent with Judaism. A lot of people will talk about the Jews in the Old Testament. That's a little bit of anachronism. Abraham was not a Jew, because the word Jew means somebody from Judah, and Judah wasn't born yet. Abraham is the ancestor of the Jews. But we have to sometimes remember that Judaism is something that developed out of the religion of the Old Testament. It's not simply identical with it, has significant differences. Also, the nascent Judaism that we see in the New Testament is not simply identical with Rabbinic Judaism as we know it today. Rabbinic Judaism that we know today has the Torah, but they also have the Mishnah and the Talmud. The Mishnah did not exist in the time of Jesus. That was not written until 200 AD, and the Talmuds were written even later. So what we see in the New Testament is not Judaism, but Judaisms. There's many different types of Judaism. There's, of course, the Sadducees. There's the Pharisees. There's a group called the Essenes. And, of course, the Christians at first were a Jewish sect, were they not? A sect of Judaism. So Judaism was very, what shall I say, diverse in New Testament times. And some people will say, well, Judaism is the mother of Christianity. Actually, Judaism is the sister of Christianity. They both come from the same stock, and they kind of grew up together when it comes right down to it. Okay? Step two, discover the occasion of writing. Am I going too long here, Pastor Mike? The occasion is basically what set of circumstances prompted the biblical writer to write. What was happening that inspired them to produce this text? How knowing the occasion gives us a clue as to the author's intention. If you know what was happening that inspired the biblical writer to write, then it tells us what his motive was for writing, why he wrote it. It reveals the author's purpose in writing, what he hopes to accomplish by writing it, and it tells us the issues that are being addressed. And also it gives us a clue as to the relationship between the writer and the readers. So oftentimes when we read the Bible, we read the letters of the New Testament, for instance, we're reading somebody else's mail that was sent to them first, and we basically have a third-person perspective on these documents. Someone has compared it to listening in to one half of a telephone conversation. We don't always know what's being said on the other side of it. Sometimes we have to go by what's being said in the letter to try to figure out what was happening that the letter is a response to, because we only get one side of the argument. So it's important for us to know the occasion so we can try to ferret out exactly what's going on in this text. We need to know something about the biblical writer. Who was the author? What do we know about his background? What do we know about the circumstances at the time of writing? And once again, what kind of relationship did he have with the author? What about the biblical audience? Who were they? What were their circumstances? What was going on in their lives at the time the book was written? What kind of environment did they live in? You stop and think about, for instance, the book of Galatians. What was happening in Galatia that inspired Paul to write that book? We all know that Galatians was written because there were Judaizers at the church. The Galatian churches were Gentile churches primarily. And there were Jewish Christians who were there trying to convince them that they had to become Jewish in order to become Christian. And Paul wrote the book of Galatians to address that issue. And so it helps us to know who the audience was and what was happening in their life. And step three is investigate the biblical actors. Okay? And so we basically ask the basic questions. Who were they? When did they live? Where did the events occur? What is their history? What did they know or not know, and why did they act as they did? So these are questions. On your table is a discussion sheet, and basically it has to do with the book of Philemon. And so what I would like you to do is to look at that discussion sheet. I'd like you to read the book of Philemon. It's only like 23, 25 verses long. And maybe identify who the people are that are mentioned in that text and what the situation was that gave rise to it. And so just take the rest of the time here tonight and get with the people at your table and work through that discussion sheet.